retrieve their favorite 06 photos and memories. A celebrated sculptor and gardener captured her in bronze. National Geographic's Nat Geo Wild Channel began working with Bob Landis on a documentary about her life. Doug Smith, like Bruschino, was fielding his share of angry calls. Some longtime wolf advocates seemed to feel that collaring 06 had led to her death, and more than one called for Smith's resignation. Much of the funding for the Wolf Project came from private donors, money raised by Smith himself. He had long told donors that the project offered a chance to invest in research on an unexploited wolf population, a rare opportunity in North America or anywhere else in the world for that matter. But the death of 06, along with so many other collared wolves that fall, called the entire premise into question. Why should donors continue to sponsor collars if hunters were just going to shoot the wolves wearing them? Everybody wanted to know what would become of the pack, but Smith had no answer for them. 4 days had passed since 06's death, and the Lamars still hadn't returned from Crandall. It was possible they would not return at all. When an alpha died, especially a female, packs tended to splinter. 755 would certainly need to find a new mate, at least, and there were no females in the pack who were unrelated to him. With breeding season approaching, he was probably already looking, and the search might lead him anywhere. The best Smith could tell people was that with 06's death, the quota had been filled in the Crandall area. As long as the pack didn't drift too far east, they should be safe, at least for now. The Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission met the Monday after 06 was shot. The meeting had been scheduled for months, but her death dominated the agenda. Commissioners announced that they would entertain a proposal to close down several hunting zones north of the park, including the subunit near Jardine, where 3 collared wolves had been taken already, in response to the high number of collared wolves killed in the hunt that fall. With the trapping season set to begin in just a few days, the prospect of the park losing several more wolves was a real one. Doug McLaughlin and several other watchers made the trip to Billings to attend the meeting and speak in favor of the closings. In the end, the commission voted 4-1 to close down the zones. That night, the Lamars came back to the park at last, and the next morning, all 11 were sighted, rallying near the base of Druid Peak. Rick observed 776, scent marking like an alpha. She was the clear candidate to succeed her mother, but just how that would happen was anybody's guess. The watchers enjoyed a few days with the pack all together in their old haunts, but it didn't last. On December 15th, they were spotted heading over Norris once more. And for the next 2 weeks, Rick was reduced to receiving periodic reports from a friend with telemetry equipment east of the park. The pack stayed in Crandall for a few days, but then, leaderless and adrift, they set out farther east. By December 22nd, they were 40 miles out, which put them in an open hunting zone where the quota hadn't yet been met. Fortunately, they didn't stay long. By New Year's Eve, 755, 776, and 820 were back in the park, but the remaining pack members were nowhere to be found. The trio howled and howled from Druid Peak, but there was no reply except from the Junction Butte pack far to the west. If the Junction wolves decided it was time to take the valley, 755 could do little to stop them, with only himself and 2 daughters to defend it. On January 2nd, the Montana Outfitters and Guides Association, joined by a local Montana state representative and a trio of hunting groups, sued the Game Commission, arguing that the vote to close the wolf hunt near Jardine had been taken illegally, since it wasn't posted on the original agenda and the public was not given the proper notice. A local judge granted a temporary injunction, and the areas were immediately reopened to hunters and trappers. The state legislature, meanwhile, began debating a bill that would prevent the commission from instituting any such mid-season closures in the future, or creating any kind of a buffer zone around Yellowstone, where hunting wolves was prohibited. The message was clear. As far as the state of Montana was concerned, there was no such thing as a special wolf. Doug McLaughlin decided he'd had enough. He announced that he was raising money for a new campaign, to be known as the War of 754, in memory of his favorite wolf. Publicly, he told donors that the money would go to raise awareness about the killing of collared wolves, which was true as far as it went. But he felt more drastic measures were in order, and these plans he discussed only with a few close friends. He went to the wolf office and requested logs of locations recorded for wolves wearing GPS collars. The logs were public information, and Doug wasn't obliged to tell anyone why he wanted them. From the location data, he identified the most common paths that Northern Range packs used when they left the park. Over the course of the next few months, he hiked out to the locations marked on his map, his backpack loaded down with tools for a guerrilla campaign against hunters, high-pitched noise emitters and radio signal jammers, along with car batteries to power them. At the park's boundary line, he planted his noise emitters, each equipped with a motion sensor, facing back toward the park's interior to discourage approaching wolves from leaving by their accustomed routes. The signal jammers he pointed in the opposite direction, to prevent anyone nearby from monitoring signals from radio-collared wolves coming down out of the park. He wasn't sure if the devices were legal, but he didn't care. He was certain the other side was breaking the rules, and he had no interest in losing an unfair fight. On January 13th, two Lamar pups, now almost fully grown, were captured and collared in the Crandall area, where the pack, including 755 and his adult daughters, seemed to have localized. Now that wolves had been returned to state control in Wyoming, Mark Bruschino had begun his own collaring program to keep tabs on their numbers and movements. One of the pups he caught was the spirited black male who had caught Rick's eye. He was now known as 859. It was an ominous development. In addition to general research, state wildlife officials used collars for a purpose that never came up in Yellowstone: tracking wolves believed to have been involved in cattle depredations. The collars made them much easier to find and kill. Beyond that, the symbolism of the act wasn't lost on the watchers. The Lamars, or at least some of them, were Wyoming's wolves now. On January 20th, 755 came back to the park alone. He was spotted on a knoll above Slough Creek, cautiously investigating a kill the Junction wolves had made in the area a few days before. Rick and Doug stood behind their scopes on Bob's Knob with a couple of other watchers as 755 moved slowly across the mountainside, his nose to the ground, warily watching for the pack he knew couldn't be far off. He made his way up to the old den site, the center of so many good memories for both him and the watchers. Rick was grateful that he was back in the park, but it wasn't easy to watch him come back to this spot as he was now, a lone wolf, bereft of 754, his constant companion, and 06, his leader and mate. As they looked on in silence, Rick heard one of the watchers nearby break down and begin sobbing. Over the next few days, Rick followed 755 around the Lamar Valley as he scavenged off kills, running from the younger and faster males in the Junction Butte pack when he got too close for their liking. The Junctions had available females that 755 seemed interested in, but he could never seem to get close enough to draw one out. On January 25th, his fortunes reversed. He was spotted near the den on Druid Peak with a gray female, a Molly known as 759. She had lost her collar some time ago, but her unusually short tail made her easy to identify, and the watchers were familiar with her from the previous spring and summer when the Mollies rampaged through the northern range. Now, all the acrimony between the two packs seemed to have been forgotten. The pair stayed near each other for the remainder of the week and were spotted in a tie. 755 had found a new mate. The project began calling the pair 755's group, just as they had when he and his brother first connected with O6 3 years earlier. Doug Smith managed to dart 759 and fit her with a new collar. She was spending more time near the den on Druid Peak, suggesting that she was pregnant and looking for a good place to settle in. It was the first bit of good news about Yellowstone's wolves in some time. When a reporter from a paper in Missoula called wanting to do a follow-up story on O6's death, Rick told him that despite everything that had happened to the pack that winter, 755 had landed on his feet, and the prospects were good for another litter of pups to be born in the Lamar Valley. The pair were not as inseparable as 06 and 755 had been, but at least he was no longer alone. The fate of the rest of the pack was difficult to discern. Then, in late February, Middle Gray was spotted in the Soda Butte drainage, not far from 755 and 759. For some reason, 755 seemed hesitant to greet her, and the source of his apprehension became clear when a second wolf came out of the trees behind her. He was so blonde he was almost white, and he was big. It was 856, the alpha male from a pack known as the Hoodoo Pack, which held the territory north of Crandall. Middle Gray seemed eager to reconnect, but 755 was leery of his daughter's new suitor. 755 was still in his prime, but 856 was a formidable wolf, and it was far from clear which of the two would become the alpha if the Lamars were somehow to reunite as a single pack. Finally, the two couples came together, Middle Gray sniffing the strange new female accompanying her father, and 755 tentatively investigating 856. There was no hostility during the brief encounter, which ended with each couple moving off in a separate direction. To the watcher's delight, 820 began turning up in the valley too. She was sighted near the Druid Peak den area in early March. Though still technically a yearling, she was now almost 2 years old, and her beautiful tawny coat had grown just a bit darker. Her father wasn't around, but she smelled him and seemed determined to summon him home. As the watchers looked on, she howled for several minutes, methodically turning in every direction until she had filled the valley with her calls. She seemed to be on her own. If Middle Gray wouldn't return to the fold, then perhaps 820 would. When the Lamars did return in numbers to the valley on March 12th, it was not the homecoming the watchers were hoping for. Doug, Lori, and Rick heard howling from the den area and spotted 755 running for his life, heading east across the mountainside. Then, to their amazement, the entire Lamar clan emerged from the woods. With them was not only Middle Gray's new companion, but a second hoodoo male as well, a suitor, it seemed, for 776. It was clear that some kind of confrontation had taken place in the thick woods around the den, but exactly what had happened, the watchers could only guess. The collared black pup, 859, trotted down the mountainside and out toward the river, scent trailing 755 and his new mate, 759, who had been spotted fleeing from the den forest after the morning's chaotic encounter. Confused about the confrontation, and clueless about its significance, the pup knew only that his father was nearby, and he wanted to find him. When the pair finally came together in the sage, it was a happy reunion, one that Rick was pleased to see. But then Rick got a good look at 759, and realized how disastrous the encounter at the den had been. She had clearly been brutalized, her entire back end covered with blood. She was hobbling along after 755 gamely, but she didn't look good. When they paused and bedded in the sage for a short while, 755 licked her wounds. It had to have been Middle Gray and 776 who did the damage, Rick thought, and probably some of the yearling females, too. As far as he knew, Middle Gray was the only Lamar who had actually encountered her father's new mate before. To the rest of the pack, she was a stranger. They had found her near the den they considered their own, and they had done what their instincts told them to do. With the two new males present, 755 had likely been powerless to intervene, or perhaps he had come too late. The next morning, 759 was curled up in the trees on the south side of the valley, near death. The watchers didn't yet realize it, but 755 did. Leaving his mate behind, he'd begun searching the valley for the rest of his pack. He found 776 near the Park Road, not far from the Buffalo Ranch, but the reunion didn't last long. The two hoodoo males came loping down the side of the hill above the road, with the rest of the Lamar wolves behind them. The young males were moving stiffly, suggesting that 755 hadn't fled the fight at the den the day before without inflicting some damage himself. But now 755 retreated, and when the chase ended, 776 accompanied the hoodoos and the rest of the pack back up onto the hill. She couldn't have her father and her new mate, too, and it seemed she had made her choice. They all bedded in the sage. Middle Gray and 776, the only two left from 06's first litter, 820, and the other yearlings, and the pups. 755 hadn't run far, and now he slowly made his way back toward the pack. He stood in the snow on the south side of the road and howled at his family high up on the hillside above him. When he got no response, he came closer, across the road to the base of the hill. The two males could plainly see him, but they didn't stir. Neither did the rest of the pack lying on the snow nearby. They were his offspring, all he had left from his time in the Lamar Valley. But they were no longer his. It wasn't his valley anymore, either, and he seemed to realize it all at once. He began moving west at a slow pace, stopping to look back up the hill one last time. When he set off again, he moved with a purposeful trot. He left the valley through Lamar Canyon and passed through the flats of Slough Creek, heading over Bob's Knob as he made his way. He continued west, following the creek to its confluence with the Yellowstone River, and still farther, all the way through Little America, without stopping, until he had left his home far behind. Chapter 13. Enough is Enough. In the days that followed, Rick tracked 755's movements as he continued to roam alone, heading ever westward into territory he had likely never before seen. 24 hours after leaving the valley, he was far out on the desolate and treeless Blacktail Plateau. The next day, his signal was detected near the Wolf Project offices in Mammoth, on the opposite side of the northern range, some 30 miles from the Lamar Valley. That spring, Rick watched as 755 roamed from one pack's territory to another, trying unsuccessfully to find a mate. It occurred to Rick that perhaps he never would. By the time the hunting and trapping seasons around the park concluded, 12 Yellowstone wolves had been lost, including 6 collared animals. Of the park's 10 packs, 7 had lost at least one member to the hunt, but a final insult was still to come. On April 24th, a rancher and outfitter in Jardine named Bill Hoppy found 13 dead sheep on pasture he leased a few miles from the park boundary. Montana wildlife officials determined the culprits were a pair of wolves. Rather than send government trappers, they issued Hoppy a special permit that allowed him to shoot the pair himself should they return to his property. In an effort to streamline the removal of problem wolves, the state had recently begun using such permits more often, though critics of the practice warned that ranchers didn't have the resources to determine whether a wolf spotted on their property was really a livestock killer or merely in the wrong place at the wrong time. 2 weeks later, Hoppy shot a collared female from Yellowstone's Canyon pack, known as 831. He hadn't observed 831 attacking livestock. He had merely spotted her on his pasture. When Doug Smith heard the news, he looked up 831's tracking data and found that she had been near Mammoth, 10 miles away, both the day before and the day after the sheep were killed. He couldn't be sure, but he strongly suspected that the state of Montana had allowed Hoppe, long an outspoken critic of wolf reintroduction, to kill the wrong wolf. Word got around, meanwhile, that Hoppe hadn't promptly removed all the sheep carcasses from the property, as was customary in Greater Yellowstone, to prevent other predators from coming to the scene. 831 might have been attracted to Hoppe's pasture not by the presence of livestock, but by the smell of carrion. Smith had reached his limit. He told a reporter from the Bozeman paper what he thought had happened, and the paper ran a story that did not look good for Hoppe or Montana game officials. Its suggestion that the wrong wolf had been shot outraged game commissioners, but Smith didn't care. He was tired of playing politics. Montana officials came to Hoppe's defense, noting that he had legally shot 831 and disputing Smith's claim that she probably hadn't attacked the sheep. Not long after the story came out, however, Hoppe surrendered his right to shoot the second wolf and moved his remaining stock to another pasture. The identity of the hunter who shot 06 remained something of a mystery. Unlike his friend Mike Hirsch, Turnbull had kept his name out of the papers. Rumors were flying in the park, however, about who he was and where he might be found. Rick had learned his name. Several people in Silvergate knew Turnbull, but kept the information to himself. He'd heard quite a few watchers say they'd like to chew him out, but that wasn't Rick's style, and he'd discouraged them from seeking a confrontation. One afternoon, however, he found himself at the Painter outpost in Crandall. Overhearing two men talking, Rick realized that one of them had to be Turnbull. He was only a few steps away, but Rick was uncertain about what to do. He felt he should say something, but he wasn't sure what. "Hey, I don't want to be any trouble," he imagined telling the hunter. "I knew her. If you want to talk about her, I'd be happy to do that." He thought it would be good to know something about Turnbull, to know what had motivated him to shoot a wolf, and maybe Turnbull would tell him what 06's final moments were like. He was the only one who could. In the end, however, Rick said nothing. He just walked out to his car and drove back to the park. The enormous backlash following 06's death seemed to change the dynamic in the national debate over wolves. 6 months after her death, Fish and Wildlife published its proposal to delist wolves throughout most of the lower 48. The agency received more than 1 million comments, the most ever submitted in response to any such proposal for any species in the history of the Endangered Species Act. The vast majority opposed the move, including the young followers of an enterprising ninth grader from Olympia, Washington, named Story Warren, who had created a popular Instagram account called Kids for Wolves in the wake of 06's death. On February 7, 2014, a panel of experts assigned to review the delisting rule released their long-anticipated report. To the surprise of many, they unanimously rejected the proposal, finding that it wasn't based on the best available science. It was the first in what would become a string of victories for wolf advocates that year. On September 23rd, Judge Amy Jackson reversed Fish and Wildlife's delisting rule for wolves in Wyoming, immediately returning them to the endangered species list. Jackson found that the state's refusal to agree to manage for 150 wolves, as Idaho and Montana had done, instead of the bare minimum, meant that the species wouldn't be adequately protected under state management. She directed Fish and Wildlife to return to the bargaining table with the state of Wyoming. The state's fall hunt was canceled, to the jubilation of advocates everywhere, especially those who were following the fate of 06's offspring east of Yellowstone. Wolves in Crandall would be safe, or at least as safe as they ever were. Less than 3 months later, advocates had cause to celebrate once again. U.S. District Court Judge Beryl A. Howell, another Washington, D.C. justice, ruled that wolves in the upper Midwest must be returned to the list as well. Since hunting was first authorized in 2011, Michigan had yet to hold a full wolf hunting season, and in fact voters there had already rejected wolf hunting in a statewide referendum held shortly before Judge Howell's ruling came down. In Wisconsin and Minnesota, however, hunters and trappers had killed more than 1,500 wolves over the previous 3 years. That was too many, according to Howell, who chastised Fish and Wildlife in her decision. The D.C. Circuit has noted that at times, a court must lean forward from the bench to let an agency know in no uncertain terms that enough is enough, the judge wrote. This case is one of those times. By the time the Yellowstone Wolf Project marked its 20th anniversary, on January 12, 2015, the tide seemed to have turned. The nation's papers and news sites were filled with stories about the benefits of wolves in the ecosystem. The term trophic cascade suddenly seemed to be everywhere. National Geographic and a host of other publications, meanwhile, prominently reported on a study by a Washington State University ecologist that called into question the benefits of culling wolves to protect livestock. It seemed that more culling led to more livestock predation, unless the culling was large enough to seriously reduce the wolf population. The reasons were unclear, though some biologists speculated that smaller packs and the existence of more lone wolves from splintered packs, both functions of exposure to hunting and culling, led to more attacks on easier prey, like livestock. In the fall, members of Congress tried once again to attach a wolf-related rider to a must-pass budget bill, as Senator Tester had done in 2011. This version would have reversed both Judge Jackson and Judge Howell's rulings, legalizing wolf hunting in Wyoming, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. Like Tester's rider, the language in the measure would have prevented a judge from reversing the move. But this time, things were different. Perhaps mindful of the overwhelmingly negative public response to Fish and Wildlife's proposal to delist wolves nationwide, 25 senators, led by Barbara Boxer, the California Democrat, signed a letter to President Obama urging him to veto any budget bill that undermined protection for endangered species. Obama let it be known he wanted a clean budget bill with no mention of wolves or any other endangered species, and congressional leaders declined to adopt the rider. After years of defeats, wolves were finally winning again. In Idaho and Montana, however, things had changed very little, at least from the wolf's perspective. Livestock depredations were down, in part because wolves had learned to avoid ranches after 2 decades of heavy culling, but also because ranchers had become more savvy about how to protect their stock. The Forest Service had retired some of the National Forest grazing leases with the most conflicts, like the Diamond G south of Crandall, under an arrangement with a pro-wolf nonprofit that compensated ranchers for the value of the leases and the cost of relocating stock. But hunters and trappers in both states were still killing a lot of wolves, especially in Idaho. In the 5 years since legal hunting began, trophy hunters had taken over 2,500 wolves in the northern Rockies, 1,500 of them in Idaho alone. Wolf populations are notoriously difficult to estimate, but official counts showed that the total in Montana at the end of 2014 was 554, down about 100 from pre-hunting levels. In Idaho, game officials had managed to reduce the population from a high of 893 in 2009 to 770. Montana's elk populations, however, were trending up, somewhat lessening the pressure on state game officials to drive down wolf numbers with large quotas and long seasons. The same thing was occurring in Wyoming. Despite the court-imposed ban on wolf hunting, game officials reported another outstanding elk harvest in 2015, though hunters near Yellowstone were still enjoying lower success rates. Despite the heavy take of wolves in Idaho, it was felt that elk numbers hadn't rebounded sufficiently, and officials authorized nearly year-round wolf seasons in some zones. When that didn't work, they resorted to aerial gunning by game department employees. They had, on occasion, gone a step further. In December 2013, game officials hired a professional trapper and sent him deep into the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, a federal preserve along the middle fork of the Salmon River in central Idaho, so remote that it is unreachable by any road. His charge was to completely eliminate a pair of packs in the area. If not for a chance meeting between the trapper and a biologist named Isaac Babcock, who had tracked collared wolves in the area for years, the plan might have remained a secret. Babcock snapped a photo of the trapper on horseback heading into the woods, leading three mules behind him, carrying the provisions he would need for the months-long job. The photo and story found their way to the Idaho Statesman, and the backlash was immediate. But for the color film, the image, as the New York Times observed, could have been captured in the 19th century. On a warm day in the summer of 2015, Rick watched from the roadside as 7:55 squared off with a grizzly over an elk carcass. He was in the Hayden Valley, a broad plain along the Yellowstone River about 25 miles southwest of the Lamar Valley. With 7:55 was a 4-year-old female he had taken up with the previous fall. She was from the Canyon Pack, which had long controlled this part of the park. The Canyons were known for their beautiful white females, and 7:55's new mate was striking, not quite white, but a pleasing and easy-to-spot pale blonde. As luck would have it, the longtime Canyon Alphas, both 10 years old, had recently left the Hayden and moved to parts unknown in the park's interior, leaving the territory available. Rick recognized the grizzly. He was an old male known as Scarface, and he had haunted this part of the park for years. He'd taken over the wolves' kill on the banks of the Yellowstone the day before, and had been lying on it more or less continuously ever since. As Rick looked on, the pair tag-teamed the bear, as Rick had watched 7:55 and 06 do so many times over the years, hazing and harassing him until both wolves managed to get a chance to feed. The female departed first, heading up out of the river bottom and into a nearby stand of trees where three pups ran out to greet her. Rick knew there was a fourth in there somewhere, waiting for his mother to come home with dinner. Late in the day, his father headed that way too. After 2.5 years on his own, scavenging off other packs' kills and roaming across the northern range, 7:55 was an alpha again. He had finally found a home. Back in the Lamar Valley, the chaotic aftermath of 06's death gradually stabilized. 7:76 eventually left, following her new mate back to the Hoodoos' traditional territory near Crandall, where she settled in as that pack's new alpha female. Middle Gray's paramour, 8:56, departed with them, leaving his would-be mate behind. But another Wyoming wolf took his place at Middle Gray's side, and in the spring of 2013, to the watcher's delight, she bore a litter of pups in the old Druid Peak den. The Lamars had a new alpha pair, and the valley would host another chapter in their story. The Lamar female, 8:20, hadn't been so fortunate. Shortly after 7:55 was driven from the valley, the pack's other females began persecuting her at every opportunity, pinning her again and again, and preventing her from coming in to feed on kills. 06's death had caused the pack's breeding-age females to view one another as competitors, and 8:20's dominant sisters wanted her gone. She became a lone wolf like her father, occasionally pairing up with him for short periods, but more often wandering by herself. 18 months after 06's demise, she was dead, shot after preying on chickens in the yard outside someone's home near Jardine. Rick was glad to see a new generation of Lamar wolves denning in 06's old home, but he often found himself driving south along the park road that paralleled the Yellowstone River to check on 7:55. The old male was now 7, an age that 06, the wolf who taught him everything he knew, had never reached. His black coat had turned a rabbit gray, His new family was called the Wapiti Pack, after the Native American word for elk, of which there were plenty in this part of the park. The pack's summer rendezvous was on the far side of the Hayden Valley from the road, and sightings of the pups were infrequent and usually brief. Still, Rick found that the wait was worth it.
Epilogue. This is the author, Nate Blakesley. In the spring of 2014, I met someone who knew Stephen Turnbull. Although she wouldn't tell me where he lived or give me his phone number, she agreed to call him and give him mine. I didn't have much hope that it would lead to an interview. In the dozens of reports on the death of the famous Yellowstone wolf, Turnbull's name had never surfaced, and he had never spoken to the media. 14 months had now passed since he had taken the world's most beloved wolf, yet he was still a blank space in the story, a null, a mystery. To my surprise, I received a call from him that same night. "Hi, Nate, this is the guy you were looking for today," said a voice, booming and gruff. I offered to let him remain anonymous. We eventually agreed to use the pseudonym Stephen Turnbull, if he would agree to talk to me about shooting 06. Again, I did not have high hopes. But it seemed I had unwittingly reached out to him at the perfect moment. Bob Landis's film about 06, titled She-Wolf, had just premiered, and Turnbull had watched it. The film, which featured wonderful footage of the Lamar wolves, stayed away from the politics of wolf hunting, but it had still touched a nerve. Turnbull was ready to tell his side of the story. "I shot her, and I'm not ashamed," he boomed. "I'd do it again." We arranged to meet the following morning near his cabin in Crandall. Turnbull was waiting at a snowy pullout along the Chief Joseph Highway, sitting behind the wheel of a large pickup idling against the cold, when I pulled up in my rented Subaru. Looking down on me through the driver's window, he seemed to briefly reconsider the wisdom of his decision. He made me promise once again not to use his name. "I'm from Wyoming," he said. "I found her, and I can find you too." Satisfied that we understood each other, he told me to follow him up a snowy road to his cabin. Inside it was cozy and tidy, and once we took off our coats, he became less wary and more hospitable. He offered me some elk jerky he'd made himself earlier in the winter. It was outstanding. The walls were covered with photos of Turnbull smiling alongside various freshly killed trophies, bear, moose, antelope, and lots of elk, including some truly massive bulls. I noticed a beautiful picture of 06 in the Lamar Valley by a local photographer whose name I recognized. On a shelf along one wall was a birdcage with a parakeet inside. His name was Bubba, Turnbull told me, a gift from his girlfriend after his beloved hunting dog had died. "I don't suggest you put your finger in there," he added. We sat at a small kitchen table. The drawers and cabinets all had antler pulls that looked homemade and skillfully done. Turnbull had a stack of paper he wanted to show me, printouts of stories about 06's death that a friend had collected and brought by. "Man, there are some people out there who really hate your guts," his friend had marveled. It was true. In the months after he shot 06, Turnbull had been the target of considerable scorn, especially in the comments section of various online reports, where a few anonymous readers suggested creative and cruel ways in which he might be harvested himself. In those first few weeks, he had begun carrying a pistol with him, he told me, for fear that somebody would find him and force a confrontation. "I don't want trouble," he said. There hadn't been any, but he still seemed flummoxed by what had happened to him, a feeling that was reinforced by the bizarre experience of watching the documentary on 06, in which he was represented by a stock image of a hunter with a rifle. Millions of people were passing judgment on something he had done, one morning, alone, in one of the remotest places in the lower 48. "She didn't tell me she was famous before I shot her," he said. A few days after her death, Mark Brascino had called to let him know that some wolf advocates wanted a meeting. They were after 06's remains, he explained, so that she could be buried in the Lamar Valley. Brascino hadn't revealed Turnbull's name, but he'd offered to act as a go-between. Turnbull refused. He had no interest in a meeting, and he had no intention of giving up his trophy. "I didn't do anything wrong," he told me time and again as we talked that first morning. And yet he couldn't help but feel besieged, even though hardly anybody outside Crandall knew that he had been the one who pulled the trigger that day in 2012. Shortly after he shot 06, Turnbull had posted a picture of her carcass lying in the back of his truck on the wall at the Painter outpost. It wasn't especially gory, but she was clearly dead. One day a government trapper who was a regular at the cafe asked him to take it down. It would only stir up trouble if people realized which wolf it was, he explained. The trapper was an old friend, and Turnbull reluctantly complied. From time to time, he'd overhear a tourist asking about the famous wolf who had been shot in Crandall, but he'd always played dumb. Turnbull seemed genuinely mystified by the watcher's enthusiasm for individual wolves, but was also curious about it. I mentioned that some wolf advocates had held a memorial service for Yellowstone wolves that had been killed in the hunt, including 06. He said he wished he'd known about it, because he would have gone. Not to be disruptive, but just to see what it was like. Turnbull knew about loss. About 3 months before he shot 06, his younger brother had died suddenly of a heart attack. He'd been an outdoorsman too, and at his funeral, a family friend had sung "A Country Boy Can Survive," Hank Williams Jr.'s defiant tribute to rural life. Then, a few days into the furor over 06's death, he lost his uncle Wayne, the old hunting guide turned delivery driver. Turnbull seemed acutely interested in what people in the park thought of him. "I don't want them thinking I'm the world's biggest asshole," he said. "That's not me." Then he described for me what happened the day he'd shot 06, the details spilling out as though he'd been waiting for someone to come and give him a chance to tell the story. When he reached the part about 7:55 and the rest of the pack howling over 06's body, he suddenly seemed to realize how this scene would play when I relate it to the watchers back in the park. "It was almost sad," he acknowledged. "I'm a hunter, but I'll admit that." "Do you want to see it?" he finally asked, after we'd been talking for an hour or so. It took a moment to register what he was referring to. I hadn't imagined that he'd have 06's pelt there in the cabin. He stepped into a back room I couldn't see. When he returned, he had an enormous gray wolfskin draped over his arm. He proudly hung it on a hook next to the door, so I could see how long it was. Most of his trophies were at his house in town, he explained, but this one was special. He usually kept it hanging on the wall, with the receipt for his wolf tag tacked up above it, so everyone could see he had shot her legally. He urged me to feel the fur. He'd shot her at the height of winter, and her coat, amazingly soft, like a rabbit's, was as thick as it ever would be. He'd had her tanned professionally, and had ensured that every inch of her hide was preserved, including her paws, so that the pelt could be used to create a full mount, the kind of specimen you might see in a museum diorama, if he decided to spend the money to have it done. There was no sign of damage from the collar she had worn. Good taxidermists could excise such flaws, and seamlessly rejoin the skin, he explained. "Now that's a trophy," he said. When Turnbull noticed me shooting video with my phone, he urged me to stand next to the pelt so people could get a better sense of how big 06 had been as he took over filming. Reluctantly, I did, holding out one of her legs to show how wide her paws were, examining her long snout, now devoid of teeth. It was impossible not to think of the countless stories I'd heard about what she'd done with those tireless legs and those formidable teeth, the elk she'd taken down single-handedly, the territorial battles she'd won, the pups she'd reared, the loyalty and love and fear she'd inspired, and the enormous and magnificent stage upon which she'd done it all, in front of her thousands of fans. Now she was hanging from a plastic hook in a two-room cabin, with an audience of just Turnbull and myself and Bubba, silently looking on from his cage. It felt profane, though I had no idea how to explain to my host why. Instead, I stepped quickly out of the frame, took my phone back, and turned off the camera. I visited him several more times over the course of the next 2 years, and each time he became more open and friendly, which was more or less his default mode with everyone he encountered. I came to understand that he had built his life around his favorite pastime, like a ski bum with a bow and arrow and a rifle instead of a snowboard. Despite how angry it made him the first time he watched it, he had rewatched the 06 documentary several times, marveling at the scenes of ungulate behavior more than anything else, he told me. A scene in which a herd of bison shunned an elk calf trying to hide in their midst from nearby wolves fascinated him. "I'd never seen anything like that before," he said. Hunting was an intellectual pursuit for him. You had to know your prey, and you had to take them ethically. He spoke often about the principle of fair chase and what it meant to him. He wanted me to know he'd followed the Lamar wolves' movements for weeks before he found them, driving around Crandall looking for tracks and listening for their howls. "I put in my time to get that wolf," he said. On one visit, he agreed to take me to the location in the valley where he'd shot 06. But when we got close, he seemed strangely reluctant to show me the exact spot, driving by quickly and gesturing vaguely toward the area. It was private property, he said, and though he had permission to hunt there, he didn't feel good about taking me there now. When I returned later without him, I began to realize why. Crandall was undeniably spectacular, yet the place where he'd found the wolves that morning was disappointingly prosaic. 06 had died perhaps half a mile from the Chief Joseph Highway, on a piece of ranch property that hosted a modest house, a couple of outbuildings, some man-made stock ponds, and a row of farm equipment. Turnbull had spotted 06 and 755 between a hayfield and a 25-yard-wide strip of close-cropped grass that served as an airstrip for the landowner's small plane in the summer. 06, the queen of a wilderness beyond compare, had been shot more or less in someone's front yard, or what passed for such in Crandall. Standing near the spot where she died, it occurred to me that no special skill had been required to bring her in either, other than good marksmanship. Turnbull had parked his truck, walked maybe 150 yards, and sounded his rabbit distress call. The wolves had come right to him, stopping a couple of football field lengths away, a reasonable distance with a modern rifle scope. No doubt to 06, the man standing in the willows was like any of the thousands of humans she'd encountered in Yellowstone from a similar distance. Not a threat. Whether it had been fair chase was debatable, but it was not a good story, and Turnbull seemed to know it. I suddenly understood Louis Carey's wry smile when I'd told him whom I had come to Crandall to find. "The great wolf hunter," he'd said. Over the course of the 2 years that followed our first interview, Turnbull's feelings toward wolves seemed to harden somewhat, especially after Judge Jackson returned Wyoming wolves to the endangered species list in 2014. During our final meeting, he told me that for the first time in his life, he'd failed to draw a tag for an elk in the upcoming fall hunt. The elk were simply not there anymore, not like they used to be, and they didn't seem to be coming back. "I'm against wolves," he told me. "I want to make sure that's clear." I assured him that it was. On a beautiful afternoon in June 2015, Yellowstone's wolf watchers gathered in Silvergate to celebrate Rick's career. He wasn't retiring, but it had been 20 years since he'd come to Yellowstone, and to his friends, it seemed as good a time as any to show their appreciation. They had reserved the cavernous main hall of the Range Rider, a 100-year-old hotel made from old-growth pine logs that was by far the biggest building in town. At least 100 people had made the trip to town for the occasion, making it the largest gathering of the far-flung tribe in years. The lodge was only 200 yards from Lori's house, but it was too far to walk in her heels and dress, and she arrived on the back of a four-wheeler, clinging to the driver's shoulder with one hand and holding her hair in place with the other. Inside were rows of chairs filled with all the people Rick had helped to find wolves over the years, the ones for whom a single visit wasn't nearly enough, who had returned to the park time and time again. Some of them he saw only once a year, but he remembered their names and their favorite wolves. Doug McLaughlin was there, of course, along with Jeremy Sunder Raj, on summer break after his first year at the University of Montana, and Bob Landis, with his ever-present camera. Landis took a seat in the front row so that he could film the occasion. As the audience looked on, Marlene Ford, the veteran watcher from Salt Lake City, presented Rick with a quilt with an image of a wolf and a bound collection of letters written by the watchers themselves, each describing a favorite memory of Rick. As Rick stood quietly nearby, looking somewhat uncomfortable, Ford explained the significance of the gifts and spoke briefly about what Rick had meant to her. Finally, she handed him the quilt. "Okay, thank you," Rick said a bit too abruptly, and the crowd tittered knowingly. The afternoon's highlight would be a story from Rick himself, and he had worked on it for weeks in honor of the occasion. Doug Smith stood up to introduce him, drawing a laugh by recalling the subject of the first meeting he attended when he took over as project director almost 20 years ago. It concerned what to do about a headstrong seasonal ranger named Rick McIntyre. Then he turned serious. After years as Rick's supervisor, he told the Watchers, these days he sought him out just to talk sometimes, especially when things weren't going well, because Rick always gave him a boost. I kind of need Rick, he said, and I think everybody here needs Rick. He really is the glue that holds us all together. And the Wolves need him too, he continued, perhaps more than Rick knew. It wasn't just that he had watched more wolves, as Smith put it, than anybody in the history of humanity. It was the community he had helped build, a confederation of people who cared about wolves, one whose impact was felt far beyond Yellowstone. For his talk that afternoon, Rick had decided not to speak about 06. Her death was still too raw, and he was still processing what her story meant. It was bad enough that he still encountered visitors 2.5 years after her death who hadn't yet heard the news and wanted to know how many pups she'd had that spring and where they could spot her. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, Rick would begin, and watch their faces fall. When a producer for a well-known radio program asked him about her legacy the previous summer, all Rick had been able to come up with was a story about a kindergarten class from a town near the park that had visited not long after she died. I know the man who shot that famous wolf, one of the boys announced before Rick could even begin his talk for the small group of kids. My dad just bought a license to kill a wolf, he added. And Rick, who still found it difficult to even talk about 06, braced himself for what was coming next. But I hope he doesn't, the boy said, and Rick found himself filled with optimism. Today, he wanted to talk instead about 06's grandparents, 21 and 42. It was a story he had told many times, but even now, 11 years after their deaths, he was still deepening his understanding of the significance of their lives. It was a story, he told his audience, of a great romance, like Johnny Cash and June Carter, a comparison his friends had heard him make many times before. But this time, he made their tale a story about what wolves feel, how they experience what we call happiness, joy, and a sense of connection to one another. Rick reminded his audience that 21 had never known his father. He'd been born during the brief and tragic adventure outside the park by his parents, 9 and 10, an excursion from which 10, the Wolf Project's first official alpha male, never returned, shot by a poacher while the pregnant 9 was digging a hasty den nearby. Yet when 21 and the other pups were returned to the park, they were placed in the same holding pen that 10 had once occupied. As the alpha male, he had scent-marked it thoroughly, a smell the returning pups could hardly have missed. His time in the pen, Rick suggested, meant that the young 21 had met his father, in a way. Rick invited the Watchers to imagine what an animal sees in his mind's eye when he smells a familiar scent. Does he see, as the celebrated animal rights advocate Temple Grandin had suggested, a picture of the creature that corresponded to the scent? Did 21 see his father in that pen? Rick returned to his theme, how a wolf's sensory experience helps create its emotional landscape, again and again, as he told the familiar story of the rise of the druids under 21, the valiant but gentle warrior, and 42, the matriarch who oversaw the pack's astounding growth. At last he came to the story's sad ending. 42 killed by the Mollies, and 4 months later, the aging 21's lonely climb to the top of Specimen Ridge, where Rick found his body. But why, Rick wondered, had 21 chosen to die on top of Specimen Ridge? Did he want to take one last look at his territory, like some Scottish clan leader from an earlier era? He'd puzzled over it for a long time, he told the Watchers, but he believed he had finally solved the riddle. The breakthrough had come, he told them, when he was thinking about the story of Hachiko, the dog whose name had become synonymous with loyalty in Japan in the 1930s. Unaware that his master had died, Hachiko faithfully waited at the local train station for him to arrive home from work, as had been his daily custom. He returned every day for over 9 years, always expecting to see the man, who never appeared. Suddenly Rick knew why 21 had gone to the top of the mountain. He was looking for 42. She had been by herself, far from the pack when the Mollies attacked and killed her on Specimen. 4 months had passed since she died, But for all 21 knew, she was still alive, wandering in the woods, looking for him. He had gone to the top of Specimen on the last day of his life, Rick suggested, because that was where he and 42 had gone together countless times, to mark a particular tree that served as a kind of sentry post along the edge of the Druid's territory. Of course, she wasn't there that summer day when 21 visited the spot alone. But her scent was still present, Rick reminded his audience, which would have offered 21 at least a glimmer of hope at finding his missing mate. Now the question at that moment would be, can a wolf in the wild experience what we know as joy and happiness? Rick said, his voice breaking noticeably. And my answer is yes. Rick had been speaking for over an hour, and there was not a single person in the room who didn't know how his story ended. But his audience was still rapt, the room crackling with emotion. He brought the story to a close by imagining 21's final moments. After the long climb up the mountain, the old wolf would have needed a rest, so he'd bedded down near the sentry tree, in the spot where Rick and Doug Smith would later find him. All the aches and pains of old age and the exhaustion from his long climb would have started to fade, Rick said softly, as he began to die. But even as he faded away, 42's scent would still have been in his nostrils, and in his mind, perhaps he savored one final thought, an image really, one last glimpse of the wolf that had meant everything to him. People had been sniffling in the audience for some time, and a few now cried unabashedly. It had taken 20 years, and it had come almost in spite of himself, but Rick had become a master of his craft. Looking out over the assembled watchers, their faces turned expectantly toward his, it was impossible to deny the essential truth of what Smith had said before Rick began his talk. He was needed. And therein, maybe, was the meaning of 06's death. While she lived, Rick, along with Lori and Doug and so many others over the years, had told thousands of people about her life, most often on the side of the road in the Lamar Valley, but also in media interviews and in countless gatherings like this one. Yet it wasn't until she was dead, until the New York Times saw fit to give her an obituary, that Rick realized just how far her story had traveled, how powerful the simple act of storytelling could be. Maybe it didn't matter if he never wrote his book about 06. Maybe, in a way, he already had. Sitting with a couple of friends in his cabin after the gathering ended, Rick made an announcement of sorts. Lately he'd been thinking, he said casually, that maybe it wasn't so important that he be in the park every day. After all, he could easily get reports from Lori or Doug or any number of other watchers to keep him up to date. After 15 years in the park, including, according to his calculations, over 85,000 wolf sightings, he was beginning to see things differently. Looking back on it, he was proud of his streak of consecutive sightings, but he was also relieved that he was no longer in the midst of it. He was calmer now, less anxious, or at least he was trying to be. If he didn't need to see a wolf every day, then maybe he didn't need to be in the park every day either. In late summer, he finally did take a break, though not for the reasons he anticipated. After a few weeks of feeling short of breath, he visited the doctor. 2 weeks later, he was in a hospital in Billings, having heart surgery. As he recovered at home, Lori and Doug kept him up to date on what he was missing in the park. Every night during his recovery, he had the same vivid dream, in which he looked out the window of his hospital room and saw the Lamar wolves running across the hills. 9 days after his surgery, he was back in Yellowstone, watching those same wolves and helping other people do the same. He was driving another donated vehicle these days, this one a silver Toyota SUV decorated with enormous color decals depicting scenes from the park. Stretched across one side was a large photo of 06, with the snowy peaks and bucolic fields of the Lamar Valley arrayed behind her. Rick found that visitors loved the image, especially kids, who would flock to the car when he pulled into crowded lots. 06 could still draw an audience. As good a reason as any to begin telling a story.
This has been an unabridged production of American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West by Nate Blakeslee. This is Mark Bramhall. This audiobook was directed by Harry Nangle. Executive producer, Linda Korn. Text, copyright 2017 by Nate Blakeslee. Production, copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.